You want to start?
Sure. So today is what? June 14th. It's Tuesday.
June 14th. Yeah.
Rachel and I, Marissa, are interviewing Professor Mo Khalil about synthetic biology and policies and practices. Could you please define the term synthetic biology?
That's a hard question.
We know.
I have a very simple definition, which I think covers most things that are being done in synthetic biology. I just call it the engineering of complex biological systems from genetically encoded parts. And that sort of practice of engineering these complex biological systems can be for the application of science and the application of understanding the biological systems, as well as for, you know, applications related to sort of industry or medicine or other things like that.
So, following up on that, what do you think what does synthetic biology mean to you?
Personally, I favor the use of synthetic biology as an approach, as opposed to synthetic biology as a sort of a discipline. And why I think that's important, I think that's part of the issue, right? That it's been sort of distinguished from other parts of biology and genetic engineering as something totally different. But I think it is different, but I think it's basically an approach. And what I mean by that is, think about the analogies to sort of, you know, how proteins were studied, protein structure function, right? The elucidation of protein structure function, and then sort of creating new structures and solving their structures and then understanding their functions. Whereas synthetic biology is a similar idea, structure function, but just at the level of multiple proteins, multiple genes, a system. Right? So I really favor that sort of definition of synthetic biology as sort of this approach to both elucidating and utilizing these sort of systems of interacting parts in itself. And why I think that's nice is it kind of keeps it somewhat, you know, it doesn't necessarily, you know, make it out to be something very sort of alien, like some people liked it, right? So, yeah.
Could you please describe your field of work and why you're performing research in that field?
Yeah, sure. You know, along the lines of what I said is sort of foundational understanding of biological systems and utilizing this new approach, right, this structure function at the level of a system, right, we're really interested in a few things. One is gene regulation in eukaryotes primarily. We're interested in understanding how cells make decisions to turn on genes and turn off genes, right? That's what seems to be something very simple, right, that we've been studied forever, but is actually a very complicated process. And so we use synthetic biology as sort of this bottom-up approach to understand how this works. You can imagine that the way biology is typically, you know, practiced is oftentimes through sort of perturbation-based approaches, so knockout, things like that. So you take away something,
yes,
or you knock it down, right? And that'll give you some insight into sort of how, for instance, maybe genes are regulating each other. But it can only give you sort of limited insight, in my opinion, if you're really interested in the functionality of that system. And so an alternative way of studying that system is to sort of construct bits of it, right? Either constructing pieces of it and perturbing it in those ways, or constructing fully artificial versions of those things. So we really favor that approach, where we construct fully artificial versions of things like transcriptional circuits,
mm-hmm,
and try to understand how those transcriptional circuits respond to things in the environment to turn on genes, how those systems execute logic functions, how those systems execute, I would say more importantly than logic, dynamical things, right? How to, you know, biology is a dynamic thing, right? There's and all of these systems are basically executing very complex dynamical functions, and we're really interested in elucidating those. So that's kind of one area. And then we have a number of other general interests, but that's sort of our bread and butter. Other interests happen to be sort of utilizing tools from synthetic biology to solve certain problems. And the one that we've become really interested in is antibiotic resistance. As you guys probably know from the news and everything, antibiotic resistance is a huge problem. We're approaching a point where we're, you know, maybe even entering a post-antibiotic era where no antibiotic is going to be useful anymore because we've got bugs that have grown resistant to everything. So we're thinking about new ideas about how you can use molecular tools and synthetic biology tools as sort of sensors and other things that could help address the problem of antibiotic resistance to get to the right therapy faster and quicker. And that's just one. So, and then we have a whole bunch of other projects, but I'd highlight that one because it's, I think, a useful, you know, an easy one to sort of, you know, explain. Yeah.
Makes sense.
Why would you say the public should care about synthetic biology?
I think you should care about synthetic biology because I think there's potential for really great advances in a number of industries. Why I like the idea of synthetic biology is it provides sort of tools and foundational ideas for creating, for making biology an engineerable substrate, right? And so we've done this with, you know, mechanical things, we've done this with electrical things and chemical things, right? But now we're entering an age where, you know, the living matter is sort of the next substrate for engineering with very useful properties, right? The ability to sense things in different ways, the ability to adapt, right, and evolve. And we should harness those things for the creation of, I think, new technologies. And I say that very vague. I say that very generally, but I think what's really interesting, if you think about it that way, it's sort of biology as this kind of like new substrate, is then it can have impacts in lots of areas, right? One of them being medical or therapeutic, which everyone, you know, thinks about in terms of biology, but that's just one. And I think if we can think about, you know, understanding how cells respond to things in the body and executing actions, then you can develop new therapies, right? So things like cell-based therapies, which are fundamentally more interesting than small molecules, right? And being really utilized now for things like cancer and regenerative medicine, right? Whereas small molecules will sort of not be able to, will hit some limitations, right? So we're going to advance therapies in a very meaningful way. Right. And I think, you know, cancer and, you know, regenerative medicine are going to be the major ones there. But that's one, right? And so then you can think about new substrates for building materials, textiles, things like that, right, that are, you know, different than what we have, and maybe even better. Of course, agriculture and the environment and things like that. And you guys are going to, I'm sure, ask me questions about GMOs. And but I think there's a special, you know, I think there is a huge need to sort of begin to address, you know, the agricultural shortage, you know, with the sort of population expansion and how we're going to feed the world. Also sort of things like that are very sort of tied to that water shortage in the world. So anyway, I think that if we think about biology as yet another substrate for engineering, you know, just like we think about resistors and things like that and mechanical things, then I think we just have more of a toolbox to play with to solve these problems.
Phenomenal.
Anyway, so the public should, that's why I think the public should care about it, right?
Yeah. All right, in terms of synthetic biology and genetic engineering, what do you feel the public is concerned about?
Yeah, I think the number one thing I think is concern, there's two main issues. One is this kind of ethical dilemma of you're playing with life, right? You're tweaking life, you're playing God. And I think there's, you know, certain scientists haven't done a great job of sort of pacifying the public by using statements like we've now synthesized life, right? And I think, you know, those statements need to be, you know, very carefully made, right? So there's this kind of, when you say the concern, I think there's really two. One is kind of this ethical thing of sort of you're playing God, you're manipulating and building life, right? And then there's this sort of second thing, which is safety. Okay, ethics and safety. And safety kind of boils down to a couple things, right? Like GMOs is a great example. In the absence of any sort of evidence or data on the safety of a GMO, it's assumed that it's not good for you or it's bad for you. Also, there's this assumption that whatever it is that we're making in the lab is going to get out, right? And it's going to kill people or cause disease or whatever, right? And again, in the absence of safeguards and discussions about this, then I think I don't blame the public for having those types of assumptions, right?
How do you make people, non-scientific people, interested in your work? And then what kind of interactions do you have with the non-scientific community as well?
Yeah, well, so I have limited interaction with the non, so that's not true. I have lots of interaction with the non-science world, but, you know, as an early career scientist, my job right now is to really kind of establish our work, right? And do good science. That's my number one priority, is doing good science that will solicit funding, that's going to be appealing to my colleagues and things like that, and that will help to create the foundational tools that could then be potentially advanced, right? That said, because we're in this sort of exciting new area, you know, we do have some responsibility to sort of discuss our work and be able to contextualize it and discuss its merits to a broader audience, right? So where I've done this is, you know, with reporters, for instance, when we put a piece out or when I need to comment about somebody else's work, where we write kind of news and views for a broader audience, where we have to sort of explain or distill something that's a kind of a more complicated topic in a meaningful way. And then just general forums, you know, so I've been invited to do like talks called like sort of, one is called A Pint of Science, right? So it's like this kind of at a bar, beer hour type thing. And there's people from the science community and non-science community, and we just talk generally about what your work is, right? And why you're doing it. So I'd say in a very limited fashion compared to some of my more senior colleagues, but,
And is your research publicly funded or funded privately by non or for profits?
Right. Most of my research is publicly funded, so grants through NSF, NIH, DARPA. So federal funding, and those are sort of the big three, and they fund a lot of our work. I have a few small projects that are funded by industry through sponsored research. And those projects are very specific. You know, industry is very interested in, you know, utilizing some of the tools that we're developing or helping to sort of, you know, guide us in developing tools that could be useful for therapeutic applications, and then get sort of private money that way. I guess that's private money. Yeah. It still goes through the university, right? And
that makes sense. Yeah.
Would you say that you felt like you were receiving adequate funding for your research?
Yeah, so far so good. Yeah. So funding has been, I think, you know, it's this thing that every researcher laments about, because the funding, you know, the budgets have been pretty stable and not growing. And what that means, you know, as more people come through that, what that means is typically usually sort of the funding rates on grants has gone down as a result of that. So in general, it has been not the best climate for funding, but in our lab and I guess in college, it's been good. It's been very good. We've been able to sort of generate excitement about our work, and so yeah, everything is good right now.
This is kind of going back again, but do you feel that you adequately reach out and inform the non-scientific community about your work?
That's a hard question. So I feel like my job is to do good science.
Yeah.
Right? And to accurately convey or portray the results of our science, you know, after we write the paper, which is peer reviewed, right? And so that, after which, right, my job is often to describe our work, you know, to a scientific or a non-scientific audience. And I feel like it's my job there to just as accurately as possible and as simply as possible convey or portray our work, right? Beyond that, I don't find it my responsibility to reach out, right, to the public or for any reason, you know, unless I'm getting sort of solicitations or requests. And in that case, if I do get solicitations or requests, things like that, I'm always happy and I'm always I always accept those invitations, and I try to be very accurate about that. So I wouldn't say I necessarily go out of my way. Obviously, in just the general, you know, among the circle of people I talk with and friends that are not, you know, I do my best to discuss our work and, you know, in an understandable way.
So a little bit off of that.
Sure.
Do you feel like your research is protected from infringement? And then does this impact your openness to discuss your work?
With the general population.
Yeah, so I saw this question. What do you mean by infringement? Like, what's the...
Do you feel your work is properly protected from by patents or other people maybe taking credit for your work or using a system that you don't want them using or it's patented, anything like that?
So you're talking about intellectual property infringement.
Okay. Or, like, even before, like, you write a paper and you're working on something, like, before things are patented, do you feel your work is safe?
That's a good, so, as a junior faculty, I'm always a little paranoid.
That makes sense.
I'm always a little paranoid because the work, this line of work is very fast, right? And so, you know, things happen very quickly, and so you're always a little reluctant to share kind of novel results before they're, you know, close to publishing. That's for sure. So this becomes somewhat of a strategic thing that I'm, you know, always balancing, which is, you know, is the work ready? Am I relatively close to publication to sort of shop the work around as I go talk about it? Or is it just too early? And that'll potentially give other people a chance to, you know, go out and use it. So that's a general concern, you know, just something that I'm thinking about, and I just try to be strategic about it. So, for instance, now, you know, I'm getting close on some projects where I'm talking about it. It's not protected, it's not published, but I feel like we're far enough along where it would be virtually impossible for anyone just to come in and sort of scoop it, right? And there's enough of the way our work is, it's very unlike small molecules or, you know, something like a protein where you solve a crystal structure or something like that, and you put up the sequence, right, or the molecule, right, and that's it. It's out there. Here, I think the intellectual property is a much different model. It's actually really interesting. We're sort of exploring how these models really translate. And it's more of a sort of, you know, there's an expertise involved in how to sort of develop these modules or these systems, right, and how you characterize and then demonstrate them. And I think it's much more difficult for Joe Schmo or some researcher to say, oh yeah, you know, the Khalil lab is working on this, I'm just going to replicate or design a new one, right? It's more of a, you know, a design process. And so to your general question, I have less concerns about the stuff I do than I would if I was sort of, you know, working in an area where I was looking for small molecule inhibitors, right, or something like that. You know, that said, we actively seek IP protection through the university. We're so on certain projects, which I think has really interesting, you know, potential for translation. The process that we follow is basically, you know, anytime I go and talk about it, I don't discuss details of sequences and things like that. And that's on purpose because then as we get close to publishing, you know, with the technology development office here at BU, we file for an exploration of IP, and then we typically file a disclosure, which then gives us a year of protection, after which you can opt to file for real, you know, a patent or not. So that's a process that I'm always thinking about if it's a project that has, you know, interesting potential.
So you do, in general, feel like your property...
Yes, sorry, long-winded answer.
Just like to summarize.
Yes, I do.
So BU does a good job of taking care of your lab as far as infringement.
So far, BU's done a really nice job, and we have at least one or two officers that have been focused on our portfolio and has done a really nice job. And in fact, I'm in a situation right now where there's a company that we're involved with that would like some tools and reagents, and BU has come in as sort of the face, the legal face, and said, here's what we need to do first before we send any materials over. And so, yes, BU, so far so good. And my experiences have been positive with BU.
Okay, this is our last interview question.
Really? Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, this one went so quick.
Really? Okay. Have the other ones been more long-winded?
There's only been one other.
Doug took over 30 minutes.
Oh, okay.
He had very... And then we managed to get on the tangents. Yeah. Game, like, whatever he said, I was like, I have a question about that.
Okay, cool. Okay. So. But so far so good. Like this is all.
Yeah, no, this is okay. Exactly. All right, you're giving okay. us you're giving us good information. I don't know, this is okay. It's just an interview, Mel. You're not interviewing for a job here.
Well, anytime you turn on the video recorder, you know.
It gets nervous. It's just so we have notes for later, so we don't have to, you know. All right, so.
Okay, what regulations do you feel should be placed on synthetic biology?
Particularly Ooh. In your area of research.
Oh, boy.
Or what ones do you like that already exist, that kind of thing?
Well, so you guys are doing some research now. What regulations are you aware of?
The microbiology safety stuff and the recombinase DNA stuff, chemical safety, reagents.
The classic things.
Yeah, the classic things. So any, so I'm assuming you agree with all that.
Basically. Totally agree with all of that, right? So basically, you know, this is a way of, right, keeping databases of, you know, folks that are doing work in particular areas, like recombinant DNA and things like that, and making sure you adhere to regulations and, you know, safety measures. And I think that's all great. And, you know, there's some of our work, you know, we work in sort of even VSL2 organisms, you know, and absolutely all those regulations are critical and needed. Beyond that, I don't know, right? You know, there are definitely, so I would say in our lab, you know, we're not really exploring things that I don't think, you know, are of any concern that would require additional regulation, but certain labs are, right? So certainly labs that are working on, you know, vectors that can replicate and potentially spread, you know, like you guys are probably reading a lot about gene drives and thinking about that problem, right? These are vectors that are designed to sort of spread through populations of organisms, right? Certainly there, you know, we may need to revisit or, you know, regulations, right? My feeling is always, right, that we've been genetically engineering bacteria, yeast, we've been genetically engineering cells for many, many years, even before synthetic biology was a terminology, right? And there's not been any sort of issues or concerns, right? And that's because, right, fundamentally, anything that you engineer, I mean, unless it's sort of these sort of spreadable vectors and things like that, anything that you engineer in the lab is going to be inherently more fragile than anything in the environment. Go out on a limb and say that. Right? So this idea that, you know, anything GFP expressing bacteria that you're going to, you know, engineer in the lab, you put it out there, the fact that the idea that it's gonna, you know, potentially take over or spread, or, I think a little bit naive and, you know, probably not really, you know, an issue we need to worry about. So long as we adhere to the regulations in sort of recombinant DNA and what you're allowed to synthesize, and, you know, when you go and order oligos or genes from these companies, they have really, you know, strict algorithmic, you know, measure safety guards on what you're allowed to synthesize, right? So if anything pops up on their filters, some toxic gene or, you know, something that's, you know, some, you know, really bad virulent gene or something like that, they'll flag it and they'll, you know, not allow you to buy it unless you have some real reasons, right? And so I think there's really good sort of filters, even at the level of buying genes, right? That prevent people from doing things that cause problems. So, yeah, in our research, I don't see a need for revisiting any regulations that are beyond what's currently available for molecular biology and genetic engineering. As I said, I think there are some labs that are doing things that, you know, probably are challenging the normal models, right? Things like gene drive. Obviously, things like, you know, people who work on stem cells or embryonic stems, right, they have their own concerns there and they have their own sort of models there. So I'm not going to be, yeah, if you guys are looking for sort of like good examples or ideas of sort of like things that challenge the model, my lab's probably not that.
Yeah. It's kind of like that from Doug. So you don't think any of these regulations should be lifted?
Lifted, like the current ones?
Yeah.
No. I think it's fair. I think any other molecular biology lab would be sort of, you know, has to adhere to them. So, you know, so should be.
I did have one question that popped up me listening to you.
Yeah, sure. No,
so, generally, synthetic biology falls under either the EPA, the FDA, or I think the NIH is the third one. Do you know which agency, federal agency, you kind of have to adhere to? And do you think that, because there's three completely different federal organizations that overhead all synthetic biology, do you think that's clunky?
It is clunky. So my understanding, and I don't know all the details here, but from listening to people who are sort of policy people on this, yes, my understanding, so nothing in our work has sort of progressed to that point, but my understanding is the system right now is clunky, that certainly advanced genetic engineering challenges some models, right? And so, you know, where the FDA, for instance, is kind of the regulatory body for, you know, drugs and things like that, you know, what's the agency sort of supervising role of, you know, which agency should supervise things like, you know, GMO, you know, agricultural, and it's unclear. And so right now there's kind of workarounds. And so depending on what it is that you're doing or you're thinking about, you could be at the FDA, you could be at the EPA, and you could be somewhere else, right? And I do think it's a little bit, I think it needs to be clarified. And I'll let sort of, you know, the intermediate sort of policy people or a person at MIT that's obviously really hard about this, you know, think more about this. Where this becomes, you know, where this is needed is, in my opinion, in enhancing or accelerating the things like therapeutics, right? Cell-based therapies, rare diseases, cancers, things like that, where your population sizes can be small. And these challenge the model of, like, for instance, FDA approval.
Yeah.
Right?
And there's an entire talk about that.
You were there. So, right there. That challenges the model. And so, in my opinion, it's a shame to sort of go through the normal routes and stall, you know, drugs or, you know, therapies that could be really useful because they don't look like the normal model and the patient size is small. And so I think in those cases, and I think, you know, as he described in Europe, for instance, they're rethinking how this is done. And I think we ought to be doing this too. Think a little more clearly about how these agencies work together or whether there's different channels for approval of these types of things.
But when you go through your stuff, you go through the NIH to get approval for anything, or do you not have to worry about?
We don't have to worry about this all that much because, again,
it's all foundational.
It's all foundational. But, you know, if we do any sort of animal studies, for instance, when you talk to Wilson, you can talk to him about this, right? There's a whole kind of body here at BU that adheres to the regulations of, I think it's the NIH, for animal practices, right?
Yeah.
And so our job is really to go through the board here at BU detail out the protocols, right, there, so that they ensure that we have sort of, that we're ethically and properly doing experiments with animals and that there's a good reason for it, you know, all of this stuff. So there's a really good pathway for that. And awesome. So when you talk to Wilson, you know, he'll elaborate more on that.
Cool. He actually emailed us right at the beginning of this interview. Do you guys want to talk today?
Great. Yeah.
So it was good timing. Cool. All right. That is our last question.
Fantastic.
So, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I'm looking forward to seeing the synthesis of all of it.
Us too.
Fire away.